So I was introduced to the five aggregates when I was a new student at San Francisco Zen Center, because every day we would chant the Heart Sutra. Some days it was in English, and some days it was in Sino-Japanese. And that's where I learned about the aggregates. And the text goes, mysteriously maybe, by first evoking compassion, evoking the Bodhisattva of compassion, Avalokiteshvara, who is practicing the, usually it's called the perfection of wisdom, but prajna or panya, I like to translate it as insight. So Avalokiteshvara, when practicing deeply the perfection of insight, perceived that all five aggregates are empty and was thereby saved from all suffering, liberated from all suffering. And then the text goes on and says, form is no different than emptiness, emptiness no different than form. The same is true for feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness, in the translation that I chanted. And so I happily chanted that, and it was all empty. So since it was all empty, and a lot of the other things that go on, it says there is no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body. So all this, it's really great to chant this every day. Just no, no, no. Like, you know, it's like empty, empty, empty. And it did something to my mind where it began to loosen up some of the hard, fast concepts I had, or relationships I had to these things, or to life itself. Just like I could feel my mind kind of loosening, loosening, loosening every time, empty, empty, or no, no, no. And but one of the conclusions I came to was kind of like, well, the aggregates are not real. They're empty. There's no real aggregates. Therefore, I don't have to learn what they are. And so I merrily chanted this text, you know, for years without knowing what they were. And it didn't occur to me to go study them or anything. And I benefited a lot, that approach, because something happens when you memorize a chant and you chant it over and over again. Not only, like I said, you know, there's because of the negations in the text, it was kind of, I could feel my mind letting go, like into the mystery of things somehow. But also, there's a kind of a concentration, a kind of regularity, settling into something familiar, familiar ritual, familiar state of mind, concentrated state of mind. And some of the important decisions I made in my life arose spontaneously while I was doing that chanting. I was trying to decide whether to go to graduate school or go to the Zen monastery. And the consideration of what to do came to a head about 2 weeks before I was supposed to start graduate school. So they were all expecting me there. And so I was wondering, so it came to a head while I was chanting the Heart Sutra. In the middle of the Heart Sutra, boom, I knew that I was going to the monastery. I didn't know why. I just knew something inside welled up. Something about the negations, the letting go, something about the concentration, the focus that allowed something deeper to operate. Something that was not my conscious doing. It was not me, the doer, me, the thinker, me trying to put all the pieces in place, you know, logically, what should I do? But rather, I'd done some of that reflection before, so there was, my mind was kind of involved in that. But then I was able to put it down in some very deep way in chanting the Heart Sutra. Avalokiteshvara, when practicing deeply the perfection of insight, perceive that all five aggregates are empty and was thereby liberated from all suffering. Boom. I think they usually ring a bell after the end of that. Boom. Big, big bell. Boom. Liberating the sound from the bell, and the sound travels out into the room, into space forever, you know. Liberating that sound. Isn't that nice? So the here the we're trying to liberate you. So then I came to Theravada Buddhism, and that's where they started talking about the five aggregates. I said, oh, wait a minute. these are something, you know. Maybe it's good to know what we're negating before I negate it. Maybe it was really good for me to have negated them first and then got around to figuring out what they were. And then I held them more lightly, you know, I didn't take them quite as seriously, perhaps. So one of the things to consider in our discussion about the five aggregates is not what they are, but what the purpose is of teaching them, what the purpose is of practicing with them is. I think Kim talked very nicely about that yesterday, which talked about non-clinging. That the five aggregates of clinging, the five aggregates that, five domains of clinging, the aggregates that where we cling. And if that's the domains of all the places we cling, it's good to know what that is. What are they? So we can begin loosening up the clinging. It's hard to understand clinging, right? It's hard to understand suffering. Like I said, it can be a big mass, and it's hard to get into it and understand where do we pick it up and where do we address it and how do we get to the bottom of it. And so these aggregates are kind of meant to point to that, but they point beyond the aggregates. They point to non-clinging, to freedom. And they also point to a quality of mind. I don't want to say a state of mind, because then it becomes a thing, but a quality maybe, characteristic that can be there sometimes. And it's the metaphor or the analogy that's used by the Buddha the Buddha many times uses water to represent the mind. Fascinating that water should be the representative. I think that maybe some of you know better than me, but in Jungian psychology, where a lot of things have symbolic value and dreams, and I think they have the idea that water represents the unconscious sometimes. So I don't want to wed these two things together. It's just evocative of water and the mind, as people have often associated with. And so, to give you a description of practice, that they develop a mind that is clear. No waves on the surface, no turbulence in the water, no mud, but really clear so we can see. And so the Buddha gives a very clear description of this kind of mind. And I love all the different analogy he uses that are descriptive, because there's a way in which he's tapping into our capacity to imagine, to kind of have more than just conceptual ideas, but have a feeling for something, some embodied or maybe even emotional or some kind of feeling for it, rather than just, you know, I just say, oh, we're supposed to have a clear mind. Go to it. As I say, suppose that in a mountain glen, so already you're in the mountains. Isn't that nice? Suppose that in a mountain glen there was a lake that was transparent, clear, and unclouded. A person with good eyesight standing on the bank would see the clams and mussels and pebbles and gravel and schools of fish swimming about or staying still. They'd think, this lake is transparent, clear, and unclouded. And here are clams and mussels and pebbles and gravel and schools of fish swimming about or standing still. In the same way, when their mind has become immersed in samadhi like this, purified, bright, flawless, rid of corruptions, pliable, workable, steady, imperturbable, they extend it and project it towards knowledge of the end of clinging, end of defilements. So it's kind of grand, this description. It sets the bar kind of high, and now you can say, well, gee, you know, it's 6th day of the retreat, and I'm nowhere near that. I guess I'm a Buddhist failure. No one ever fails in Buddhism. It's not possible. But and this, these are beautiful, you know, say transparent, the mind, the awareness has a feeling of transparency, of clarity. I liken it to living here in the Bay Area and driving around. Sometimes it's foggy, sometimes it's smoggy. And from the peninsula where I live, you cannot see the mountains across the bay. And sometimes the air has been cleaned, clear and clean, smog-free, fog-free, and it's crystal clear across the bay. You see the hills there. Like, wow, there's hills over there. And what stands out is the hills, but more than that is the clarity. Now, you can't point to clarity, and you can't grab it. I can go over there and kind of try to grab the hills. You know, I can take the drive over there and do my best and put my hand on them. But the clarity is not a clingable thing. You know, if I try to grab my hand goes right through clarity. You know, it has less substance to it than the air even, but clarity. To develop a mind that's clear. So how do we develop a mind that's clear? That's mind that might be purified, bright, flawless, rid of corruptions, pliable, workable, steady, and imperturbable. It's mostly about what we don't do. It's mostly putting the mind at ease, letting the mind trust and be at ease, and for the mind to rest. Put to rest its agitation. Put to rest its searching, its wanting. Put to rest its judging, desires and aversions. It's not an easy thing to do that. But to know that we're going, and that's the direction we're going, can maybe take away a little bit of the strong interest that some of us have in all those things. It's so important to figure things out, or to try hard, or to gear up, or to think something out, or to plan ahead, or come up with a better answer to yesterday's conversation. You know, and so we're working and doing in the mind. And some people's minds are so busy doing, live their life, you know, spinning their mind, that the mind is deeply exhausted, the weariness of the mind. Some people discuss, one of the things that people can discover coming on retreat is how weary, you know, they've gotten all the sleep they needed, but they feel this deep, ancient weariness from just constant churning of the mind. And that's progress, to know that that's the case. And to know that we're going towards a kind of stillness, a vital, dynamic stillness, then maybe we begin being willing to start doing less while being alert. To have mindfulness be less something we do than something we allow for. It's remarkable to me that the Buddha nowhere tells anyone to do mindfulness. Mindfulness, asati, is always something that we abide in, we establish, we enter into. Very different kind of activities to enter into awareness, to enter, to abide or dwell in awareness, to establish it. It has a, you know, so the sati itself is not something we do, but we are doing something that allows us to enter into it or allow it to be there, to remember it. But it's not meant to be this big doing thing. So the aggregates. I love Kim's idea that fish jumping out of the water and then I guess turns around, then it's going to come back in as a description of this, these talks, this path of this retreat. And I guess we've all jumped now. And we're getting ready to turn around and back into the water. Here we're back to water as a metaphor, right? And so I was thinking about these fish that jump up and are ready to come down. And maybe there are like five fish that jump up at the same time. And they get to the top and they say, "Hey." And one of them says, "Yep." "Where do you think you're going?" "Well, I'm going to this place that's, you know, 57 degrees. "What do you mean 57 degrees? "Yeah, that's where I live, 57 degrees. "But I don't know, I'm going to the place where there's a lot of viscosity. Viscosity level is 17. "What do you mean viscosity?" The third one says, "Wait a minute. I don't know anything what you're talking about. I'm going to a place where there's all this turbulence." "What do you mean turbulence?" The fourth one says. "I'm going to the place where it has the pH of 6.5. "What do you mean pH of 6.5? "I'm going to the place where it's clear." They're all describing the river, but each of them is choosing a different part of the river as the thing that's the river. And they're each attached to it, their idea. So before they can get down, they're having a fight. "No, it's this way. This is the real thing." But the river is not any one of those things. The river is all of them and much more. The river is whole. To separate out any one piece of it, you know, and then you go around carrying the viscosity, carrying the pH, you know, "I have the river here." No, the river is all of it together makes up the river. And then you go back into the river and you experience the whole. You don't experience all the little pieces of it, all the different qualities of it. I mean, you experience it, but that's not the whole. That's not the experience of being in the river. It's not, you know, selecting one of them out of all the others. It's actually with water. It's very hard to make those divisions. It's all integrated. It's all flowing together. It's not like oil and water that get separated when you put them together. So these aggregates, are they like that? Are they actually all pieces of something that is part of a whole? Maybe, maybe not. What are they? Maybe now that we've somewhat explained to you what they might be, maybe now is to appreciate that the five aggregates are empty. Maybe now we're going to deconstruct them for you a little bit, or help put them to rest so they're not so active, so the clarity can come. One of the starting about 400 or 500 years after the Buddha, give or take a few hundred years, we don't know, arose the idea in Indian Buddhism that does not appear, an idea that does not appear in the teachings of the Buddha. And that was the idea that there is no self, but what we are is the five aggregates. And now the five aggregates have become the defining characteristics of what it means to be a human being. If you want to understand yourself, you understand the five aggregates. An extension of that is that, well, they're natural processes of the human being, and someone who's enlightened has them just as much as someone who's unenlightened, but somehow they have no clinging as part of them. They're just all part of everyone. And they've kind of been made into something. But this is not what was taught by the Buddha. And to give you one, and the Buddha talked about, he's just when he described himself, he said that he has abandoned the aggregates, cut them off at the root, obliterated them so they never arise again. Wow, that's kind of violent. The Buddha doesn't have them. That's ridiculous. Perceptions, we all have perceptions. We all have mental, we all have bodies and forms and feeling tones. And so how could this, but the Buddha said every single one, including consciousness, he's cut off consciousness, abandoned it, obliterated it, never to appear again. But he's walking around India, talking and saying this. So he must be conscious, right? This is silly. How could this be? Maybe the challenge is we haven't really understood what these aggregates are. Maybe they are something that we can bring to an end and still be alive. Be alive with clarity, with freedom, with non-clinging. The main difference between a Buddha, enlightened person, and you is the absence of clinging. It's not that grand. It's not that fantastic. I mean, it's not like fireworks, enlightenment. It's not like communing with the cosmos, cosmic consciousness. It's not like, you get to have infinite eternal bliss. It's just like, well, I'm not clinging anymore. You go to a party and somebody says, "What did you get out of your years of Buddhism?" Well, I don't cling anymore. Oh, they say. But then Avalokiteshvara, practicing deeply, the perfection of insight, perceived that all five aggregates empty and was thereby liberated from all suffering. To end clinging is to be liberated from suffering. So what is going on here? So I wanted to read this passage about where the Buddha says he obliterated the aggregates because it brings up the metaphor of water again. It's wonderful water. I love water. I love the ocean and surface of water. And my preferred way to drive across the bridge, the San Francisco Bay Area bridges, as a passenger, because then I can look at the water when I'm driving. I just love it. So one of the questions that apparently a lot of people had in ancient India is, you know, who are we? And how do we really exist? And what happens to us when we die? And so there were four questions people would ask to try to get to the bottom of this. They were talking to a spiritual teacher who was supposed to know something about this. And so the Buddha was considered to be, you know, the pinnacle of spiritual attainment. So they wanted to ask him, like, what happens when you die? Will you still exist? Or when you die, will you not exist? Or when you die, will you both not exist and exist? To be comprehensive, they'd ask, when you die, will you neither exist nor not exist? Just all the possible ways of saying that. They wanted to know, people were eager to know about this. The Buddha always refused to answer the question. He was not interested in answering the question. Is he going to exist when after he died or not exist after he died? And so there people ask that question. And this particular passage, there's a king, Pasenadi, who's asking it of one of the great nuns in the time of the Buddha named Kema. And so she gives the Buddha, the king, this answer that, you know, the Buddha doesn't declare anything about his existence after he dies. And the king says, well, how can this be? How can you do that? How can you just say that? And she says, I will question you about this matter. So she's counter-questioning. Answer as you see fit. What do you think, great king? Do you have an accountant or a calculator or mathematician who can count the grains of sand in the river Ganges thus? There are so many grains of sand. There are so many hundreds of grains of sand. There are so many hundreds of thousands of grains of sand. The king says, no, I have no mathematician or calculator who can count all the grains of sand. Then, great king, do you have an accountant or calculator or mathematician who can count the water in the great ocean thus? There are so many gallons of water, so many hundreds of gallons of water, so many hundreds of thousands of gallons of water. No, reverend lady. For what reason? Because the great ocean is deep, immeasurable, hard to fathom. I love this. Deep, immeasurable, hard to fathom. So too, great king, that form, appearances, that form by which one describing the Tathagata, the Buddha, might describe him, has been abandoned by the Buddha, cut off at the root, made like a palm stump, obliterated, so it is no more subject to future arising. The Buddha, great king, is liberated from reckoning in terms of form, liberated from being described, being measured, being sized up based on form. He is deep, immeasurable, hard to fathom, like the great ocean. Here again, water. But here, the great ocean. So he has cut off what we hear in this translation, form, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. But he somehow has become like, still somehow is like the great ocean that can't be calculated, can't be counted, it can't be measured. What is that? What is it? And then especially this thing when here in this translation called consciousness. We have this teaching in these ancient texts also that the way a person is reckoned, measured, sized up, is by what they're preoccupied with. Some people are preoccupied with their form, their body, and so we know them as being preoccupied like that. Some people are preoccupied with their feeling tones, and you can kind of tell if that's what they're about. And so that's, then you know who they are, or how they operate, or what they're oriented towards. Some people are preoccupied with their ideas, their concepts. Some people with their stories and mental formations, and some people with vijnana, this we have sometimes called consciousness. And so you can reckon, you can see, if you're preoccupied, then you're kind of, people can tell somehow. But the Buddha has no preoccupation with any of this. So there's no way of measuring him by them. There's no way of pegging him by these five aggregates. So he's not preoccupied with them. So what is his preoccupation? What does that add to this? Andrea pointed out that, I think that, the way the Pali words for the aggregates are is nouns mostly, but that they're defined as verbs, as activities. They have no substance as a noun, they're only processes, activities. But how are they that way? And this is the proposal, is they are activities that we participate in, maybe unknowingly. They're activities that we're doing, we're involved in, that we don't have to be involved in them. We don't have to do them. And so I think it helps if we translate them differently than they've usually been translated. So maybe if I offer you a possibility, you can get a more sense of this. So we translate them as verbs, first of all. So if the first one is maybe if we translate it as sensing. Sensing the sensory appearances that appear, there's a sensing of them. Feeling tones are not about feeling tones, they're about the verb feeling. We're involved in feeling. The I call it recognition, some people conceptualization, the third one. It has to do with the label, the concept that we have. So I've invented a new English word, concepting, because conceptualizing suggests like too much thinking things out, but concepting. And the fourth aggregate is constructing. Mental constructing things with the mind, and the fifth one, which I think there's been more questions on this retreat about the fifth one, because of the this issue of consciousness is so interesting to people. So we know you because you're preoccupied with consciousness. And I think that in Buddha, I'm becoming more and more of the opinion that in Buddhist English, as we talk about Buddhism in English, we should just stop using the word consciousness. Just be finished with it. And one of the reasons is that you could search high and low in academia and psychology and psychologists and neuroscience and all kinds of places. You can go high and low and all over and check out all kinds of wonderful spiritual teachers, mystics, books galore about consciousness. No one agrees. No one knows what it is, though they think they do. But maybe one of them does. But how are you going to know? There's tens of thousands of different opinions and ideas. And people didn't really use the word consciousness in English until about 200 years ago. You know, so they weren't conscious before that. They didn't have a word for it, I guess. It's a kind of a modern word that we take so much for granted. But maybe it's not even a thing. Maybe it's empty. Who knows what it is? But the way that this fifth aggregate is defined in the suttas, I think a good way of referring to it is how the third aggregate's often referred to as perception. That vijnana is perception. And so in this list I'm saying here the verbs, it's perceiving. So we can participate in sensing, feeling, concepting, constructing, and perceiving. So one way with perceiving, which is kind of the topic for today, this vijnana, is that we can perceive passively, receptively, or we can be involved in doing the perceiving. We can be searching for something. I was looking for something earlier to put those hearing system devices in. So I wasn't looking for something in particular, a bowl of some kind. And so I activated my perceiving capacity. I was searching for something. I was very involved in it. There are times where I just love sensations. So I, you know, let's go there and really feel those sensations. It's really good. And so I'm involved, I'm actively involved in participating in doing the sensing. There are times that I'm actively involved in doing the feeling tones, feeling it. Oh, that's pleasant. Sometimes we're actively involved in the feeling of unpleasant feelings, painful feelings. It's counterintuitive. It never feels like we're actively doing it. But the interest, the concern, the reactivity, the being bothered by it, being upset by it, being afraid of pain, paradoxically has us participating in it all and reinforcing it. We're participating in the concept we live in. We're concepting, we're spinning out new concepts or remembering concepts and applying concepts. One of the ways that I think is very evocative is to think of, to consider how the concepts we have are projected onto the world. The Buddha was very clear about this, that we're projecting permanence on things which are not permanent. We're projecting happiness on things which are not happy. we're projecting self on what is not self. And so these are ideas that are you know, so they're in concepting, we're also then projecting. And a lot of what we're trying to do in this practice is to quiet down the projections that we live by, the ideas that we're spinning and caught in and participating in, drumming up even more and more. I've had, a yogi mind on retreat. This yogi mind is a mind that's not quite in touch with reality, but has some creative ideas about reality. And I remember when I was in Burma, I was minding my own business, practicing, and I noticed I had a little spot on my arm, like a little, that's a little something, a little indentation, a little something. And over the days and weeks, I got like more and more like, oh my God, this must be serious. Maybe I have cancer, it'll be the end. So there happened to be a Burmese doctor who was in the monastery, and I said, can I talk to you a minute? Can I show you this thing? And I showed it to him, and he looked at me like I was like, you've got to be kidding. It was like, it's still there. I think it's completely like normal skin. But somehow in my mind, it loomed big, right? So my mind was participating in creating this idea, this projection of what was there. I was really interested. And so I was actively perceiving, I mean, looking and searching and studying and it. And I was actively constructing all these ideas. This is the end. I'll probably have to have my arm amputated. That's all kinds of things. So the proposal is the way to understand these aggregates is that they are very much activities the mind is doing. The Buddha has stopped those activities. Does that mean that he doesn't perceive, he doesn't have ideas? It doesn't quite mean that. But he is not preoccupied or selecting out one over all the others in which to live in this world. Maybe he's leaped out of the water, but he's not looking back at the water and saying the water's only this. He just goes right back in to the water, into the clarity of the water, into the current, the flow of the water. So for us, when we practice for these aggregates, these branches of clinging, it isn't so much you have to understand what they are as it is you want to start understanding how your mind is activated unnecessarily, clinging, there's grasping, there's thirsting, there's desires, there's aversions that are active ways in which we're involved in kind of creating parts of our experience of who we are. And every once in a while, it should be okay to take a vacation from doing that. And that's hard to believe. It's easier to take a real vacation sometimes than it is to let the mind know, you don't have to do all that work. You don't have to be so busy all the time figuring it out and solving the past and planning the future and judging everything and measuring yourself. And I mean, you know, little vacation, you're allowed. You're allowed to take the risk, the chance to not be always churning and wanting and doing all this doing. Does that mean that you're just going to sleep for 2 weeks? I hope not. The hope is that you'll be awake. Awake, aware, present for your experience with clarity. Not doing these five processes doesn't mean that you shut down. It means you can be present with all with, you know, in a way that can't be measured, in a way that is deep, immeasurable, like the great ocean, where there's maybe no way that you're not interested in measuring and defining and limiting. And this is who I am, and this is what I have to prove myself to be, and you know, this and this about me, myself and mine. A lot of these processes that we engage in and do are related to what Kim talked about yesterday, the me, myself, and mine, the me project that we have. But what if you're not a me? What if you're an ocean that has no way of measuring anything about it? What if there's nothing in the clarity, there's nothing you can grab? One of the really amazing things that at some point I saw, at least for myself, I saw this, that if I was going to cling, I'm always clinging to ideas, the third aggregate. Even though in principle I was clinging to the other aggregates, maybe I was clinging to, you know, something physical about myself or someone else. Or maybe I was clinging to pleasure or clinging to my thinking mind that was planning out the future or anything. But it turns out that you don't actually cling to those. I was always clinging to the idea of those things. And when I saw that, clinging is always with ideas, to some idea. Try grabbing an idea. These ideas have no weight. They have no size. And have no substance. They're empty of substance. They're empty of permanence. They're empty of self. Ideas. You try to grab an idea and you come up empty-handed. But we think we're holding on. But we're actually, I get, at some point in my practice, I had this clear feeling that even though I've done a lot of clinging, I never succeeded. I actually been a miserable failure in clinging. I've been very good at clenching up. But that clenching never could hold anything except the idea. Isn't that kind of infuriating or disappointing? Or you ready to protest to protect your clinging? What do you mean? Maybe you're better at clinging than I was. So you cling to real things. So I offer you this as a little bit of a challenge to not necessarily try to understand all this, but to begin the process of trusting that you don't have to do so much. Trusting that you can get out of the way of this life that you are, that's happening with you. And the more we practice, the more we discover how much we can just get out of the way to allow something to move through us, allow it to unfold. When it's difficult, it unfolds one way, and but it's not difficult another way, perhaps, but it's just an unfolding, just the process of Dharma just rolling through and rolling through. And then we're in the current, and the Buddha uses water analogy. The Buddha said that, oh, he used the example of, I gave it earlier, but he's very explicit about it, that a river where there's this tall, long grass that grows out over into the river. And if a person grabs the grass, and this thing, apparently is a dangerous river, so he said, then it's the end of the person. But if you don't hold on to the grass growing on the edge of the river, the current will just carry you. And he said the five aggregates are the grass. Don't grab onto those. Don't get preoccupied with those. Don't be so wedded or committed to them. To make this a little bit easier, perhaps, allow yourself to sense, but don't do the sensing. Don't participate in it. Don't lean into it or fight it. Allow there to be feelings, but don't do the feeling. Allow there to be ideas, but don't do the ideeing, the concepting. Allow there to be mental activities, constructions, but don't do it. If you don't do it, you're not feeding it. If you're not feeding it, you're not reinforcing it. If you're not reinforcing it, something else begins to happen. And then finally, don't let there be perceiving, let there be perceptions if you want, but don't actively involve in the perceiving. Take a vacation from all this stuff. And finally, the Buddha said, in describing as an analogy for these five aggregates, he said that the appearances that come to the senses, what we sense, the sensing, the sensations, are as insubstantial as foam floating on top of the Ganges River. They're empty, it's like bubbles that are floating on top. Are as insubstantial and temper the feelings that the feeling tones, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, are like the raindrops on top of the lake. Good rain coming down. You see all these little raindrops that bounce off and pitter patter, and very quick. So these. They have no enduring reality to them. That the concepts, the concepting, is like a mirage. We're seeing something that's not there. We're projecting something onto reality like a mirage. And then mental formations, mental kind of stories, this generating think it generator thinking that we can do is like a banana tree. Banana trees don't have real trunks like a tree. They just have these leaves that have wrapped tight around each other, around and around and around to make something that looks like a trunk. But if you cut the plantain, the banana tree down, you can peel apart those layers of leaves that are tightly wound, and there's no core, there's no hardwood in the middle. So it's insubstantial, it has no essence. And then the last one that I'm calling today perception is like a magic show. Magician who makes things up. Perception can be a bit of a magic show, like when Andrea saw the cat that was just a root. So when I was a Zen student, sometimes I would encounter something in the Dharma that I didn't understand. Sometimes I'd actually go and sit by myself in the meditation hall, knowing I didn't understand it. And I wouldn't try to understand it, but I would sit with a not knowing, like I was like just present for up against that, letting my mind become still and peaceful and quiet, just like, oh, the unknown. What is this? What is this? Without wanting or trying to get an answer. Maybe these aggregates, as you, now that we've come, jumped out of the river, maybe you can sit quietly with the question, what is the river you're returning to? Without looking for the answer, just the unknown. What is this? Fascinated, interested, like this is an important question. As a way of perhaps allowing your mind to have a vacation from all its mental doings and to be replaced in that not knowing mind, curious, interested, up against the unknown, with a discovery of the mind's capacity for some kind of clarity. Some kind of stillness, some kind of vacation. From all the doing, awake and at peace.